Well, it's 20 years old, and so probably no longer on many people's playlist. But I want to play you a song written by Sting from 1993, If I Ever Lose My Faith in You. And hopefully it'll draw some points that touch some cultural raw nerves. It's a love song, but a pretty unusual one, because he's being as positive as he can in a world of despair, which means not very positive at all. He's pleading for his lover to be faithful, to justify his trust in her, but if their relationship falls apart, he says, there'd be nothing left for me to do. There's nobody else to trust. She is his last hope in a world that has lost the hope of trusting. Pretty depressing when you think about it. Not your average love song, but there you go. But his pot shots are pretty all-encompassing. Science and progress, institutional religion, politicians and the state. As he says, some would say he's a lost man in a lost world where politicians are like game show hosts and so-called miracles of science that always seem to go from a blessing to a curse. Now, I think there are many reasons for this sort of Western culture of despair that I think gets represented well in this song. I've got no intention of getting all philosophical or exhaustive about it, but I just want to touch on three reasons, and my reasons will soon become obvious, I hope. And the first is this, as we ask the question, is there nobody that we can trust? And the first question is that I think we've become cynical about reality. Now, that might strike you as rather absurd. I mean, surely we all know that reality is real. What on earth does that mean? Well, it's not that we deny reality or deny the existence of truth. It's just that we doubt our grasp on them. Our world is so complex, people are so multi-layered, that we can never really know the full story, the big picture. Which is one reason people no longer trust the sort of big ideologies or the global one-size-fits-all answers. And the 20th century proved the dangers of such answers. The century was full of them. Communism, fascism, capitalism, each in its different ways has had its victims. No wonder if people have given up on the big isms. They're too neat. They leave too many people crushed under their tank tracks and their goose steps. Graham Greene's novel, Our Man in Havana, is set in Cuba in the early days of the Cold War. And one character is a German doctor called Hasselbacher. And Hasselbacher has lived in the Caribbean for years. And his English friend, who is the man of the book's title, is chatting to him about the way that Germany and Berlin lie on the sort of watershed between East and West. And he asks, are your sympathies with the East or the West, Hasselbacher? East or West of what? Oh, you mean that. A plague on both, he says. And that could sum up the way that many people think today. Whether it's science or religious institutions or politics, left or right, whatever it is, a plague on all of them. To give a sense of this feeling, just think of what it's like to watch two economists on the news. They're discussing what the Treasury should do to get us out of our financial mess that we're in all over the world. They're at it, hammer and tongs, aren't they? And you're sitting there in your living room trying to work it out. You sit there completely lost, with no idea what to think. They both perhaps seem a bit plausible, perhaps one slightly more plausible than the other. But it's just too complicated. We'll just have to somehow sort of muddle through. How are we supposed to tell who's right, who's got stronger answers? And of course, you see, every truth system, every big way of understanding the world has its flaws. And it's but just. And think of this. And every system leaves its victims. There are people who get left out, people at the bottom of the pile. It just leaves you bewildered. But it's not just a matter of knowing who to trust. We don't trust what we hear or see, especially on TV. I mean, everything is so slick, so rehearsed, so polished. We know that even the sort of apparently spontaneous jokes in political debates, they've been rehearsed for hours. No wonder Sting accuses many politicians of being like game show hosts. They've got their one-line zingers down to a T. They say one thing, and they do another. As a German poet Heine once put it, they are rulers who in private drank wine and in public preached water. And we know that the camera lies. I hope you do. It has done for decades. Take this photograph. This is a picture of Stalin, and just to his immediate right, his famous foreign minister, Molotov, and all seems fine and dandy. A friendly riverside wander in Leningrad, perhaps, as it then was. But some years later, the original photo was unearthed, and to Stalin's left is another bloke, one Nikolai Yezhov, who'd been a senior leader of the secret police. But he fell foul of his boss and was executed in 1940 during Stalin's purges. And so he was erased from all official records. Now you see him, now you don't. This is long before Photoshop. I mean, we assume that photos get doctored now. In those days, you had no idea. And it's pretty convincing, don't you think? Top left. We're more wary now, aren't we? We're much less gullible. So we watch skilled public speakers and leaders, and we assume they've got something to hide. We don't trust them, so we stop listening. We simply don't trust that what we're presented with is true reality. Secondly, I think we've become cynical about relationships. Now, this is, of course, related to the previous point, but if we cannot trust our own take on reality, even at the strictly personal level, I don't fully understand everything about people I meet, even people in my family. I'll never completely plumb their depths. Well, if that's the case, how can we trust others? Especially when they make promises to us, especially when those promises perhaps are very bold promises. I mean, who has never felt let down by close friends or family? People said they would do something, but they failed to deliver. Have you never had that sense of being let down, even betrayed? For the last 2 or 3 years, there have been some disturbing statistics. I just wonder whether this is one of the reasons why people in this country seem less and less inclined to get married. The rates for marriage have been declining, and in the last 2 or 3 years, they're at their lowest numbers ever, with more and more people cohabiting for a shortish period of time. Sometimes, I guess, people are reluctant to make the step because they're skeptical of their own ability to keep these awesome promises that marriage is all about. Till death us do part, can I honestly do that? If I'm skeptical of myself and being able to keep those, I'm going to steer clear of that sort of commitment. But more common, perhaps, is the fact that we've had our fingers burned too many times. And we're terrified of having them burned again, to be let down again. I don't think I can go through with it again, people say. But in this climate, there's a catch-22, isn't there? As Sting sang, if I ever lost my faith in you, will there be nothing left to do? So this is all I've got. But thirdly, I think we've become cynical about power. There's a poster that regularly does the rounds at election time, isn't there? With words to the effect of, don't vote, it only encourages them. Now, there are many people of great integrity and sincerity in politics. I've met a number. I do trust them. They have the best of possible motives. But we know full well, none of us is naive to this, I suspect. There are many who are not sincere or honest in public life. They're only interested in feathering their own nests, power for power's sake and all that. And, you know, the MP's expenses scandal in the last few years, that confirmed our worst fears. Well, I think there was probably quite a lot of hype about it. I think there were some unfair situations, but there were some real cases of criminal activity. They confirmed our worst fears. No wonder people get disillusioned with the powerful. Not only do we doubt they can actually make a real difference to people's lives, actually, we just don't trust the people who wield power. Isn't that one reason why we have a coalition government now? Voters wanted to get rid of the last lot, but they weren't especially keen on the other lot. Now, some may be thinking of the Christian church at this point in its historical forms, because, of course, Christians themselves are not immune from such accusations. They have, as churches down the centuries, been found guilty of all the same ills: hypocrisy, abuses of power, disloyalty and betrayal, crushing dissent. It's all there. No wonder in the song Sting included the church in his litany of despair. So far, so bad. So who on earth can we trust? Is there anybody? Well, you wouldn't expect me to leave it there. I'm definitely not going to leave it there. You see, I do think there is a way forward. There is a shaft of light amidst the gloom. And it's profoundly important, perhaps more important to understand this than ever before. And it comes from just one person. And he is different. And he makes all the difference. His name? Jesus of Nazareth. I would go so far as to say that he is my only reason, ultimately, for any confidence in this world of spin and suspicion. My only reason. Actually, the only one who keeps me going in the midst of it. Because there's simply no one else I can trust like him. Now, there's far too much to say, but just in the next few minutes, let me give you three reasons why, despite everything, there are still these oddball Christians going around who get excited about Jesus. In fact, the numbers of people going to church in this country is going up at the moment, contrary to expectations and what many people in the media might say. There is something here that draws. So I want to just give three reasons to get excited about Jesus, even in this climate. There is one we can trust. And the first is that he is truth personified. In a world that is cynical about reality, there is a shaft of light. Now, just turn to John 14, as we saw, as I read from earlier. Jesus was talking to his closest friends just hours before he knew he would be executed. For the disciples, this was an incredibly intense and confusing few days. A whirlwind of emotions, of fears, of anxieties. And Jesus is essentially saying to them, "Don't panic. It's under control. I know what I'm doing." But the reason they no doubt panicked is because it really didn't look like that. Things seemed to be rollercoasting out of control. He was about to be arrested, executed. It looked as though it was going to be game over. But Jesus says, "No, trust me. I'm going, but I'm coming back." That's weird. "But give them greater assurance," Jesus says this, verse 6, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you know him and have seen him." Now, Jesus is making fundamental and some would say outrageous claims here. Now, in essence, he is saying that he's come from outside the world to reveal the path to the world beyond. That's fairly ludicrous when you put it in those terms, isn't it? He's claiming to reveal God the Father. If you've seen him, you've seen me. And that's why he's claiming to be not just true, not just truthful, but truth. Truth personified. He doesn't claim to speak truth about the world. He claims to be the truth of the world. So, if there is something that is true in the world, if there's something true in your life, if there is something true about the cosmos and cell biology and whatever else, it is true because of him. That's what he's claiming. It's breathtaking. But actually, I find this an incredible relief. It means that Christians do not believe in a philosophy or a belief system, although it is perfectly possible to get philosophical and systematic about it, and there are good reasons why we might, and many people have done. But that's not at its heart. Because every system, whether it's got a Christian veneer on it or not, will have its flaws. But thankfully, we don't pursue a system. We believe in a person. And the reason that's a relief is that it means you don't have to be clever to get it. Since you might not get close to plumbing the depths of the truth, I mean, nobody does. But while very few people can get close to a PhD, anybody can know a person, can't they? A pilgrim stood at a signpost, paths radiating out in all directions. He was tired, he was confused, and mist sort of cloaked the hillside. And the signpost was so weather-beating as to be virtually illegible. And he's thinking to himself, which way do I go? I want to get to the city of God. Which should I take? Which route? Just as Davinder was asking the big questions of life, so our pilgrim is standing at the signpost trying to work out where to go. There are so many alternatives. As it happens, three fellow travelers come up behind him. And so he asks the first one for help and says, you know, which way must I go to find the city of God? And the first one grimaced. You don't still believe that rubbish, do you? The roads lead nowhere, just into the mist. There's no such thing as the city of God. Just pitch your tent right here. Make the best of a bad job. It's a fruitless, pointless quest. The pilgrim just sensed that wasn't right. There had to be more to life than just this misty hillside. So a second one comes up, and he asks the same question. And the man just shrugs. Who can say? Myself, I'm agnostic about this. You can't prove which one is best. Just be tolerant and open-minded. You just choose whichever path seems best to you. And, you know, don't look down on those who take that path or this path. You know, just, it's a great adventure. See what happens. I don't know. But at that point, the third turned up. And he smiled confidently at the question. It's an unnecessary question. All roads lead there. Doesn't really matter which one you take. They all appear. They just appear different. Just, you know, whichever you like. But they all converge out there in the mist somewhere. Don't worry. You'll get there in the end. It'll be fine. And we'll all meet up at our desired destination. And the pilgrim frowned. Was that honestly likely? At that moment, out of the mist, a fourth traveler appeared. Unlike everyone else, he came not from behind the pilgrim, but from one of the paths in front. It was a steep path and clearly underused because it was heavily overgrown with brambles and nettles. So the pilgrim asked this man the same question, and his reply just blew him away. The others you've spoken to, they were just guessing. They didn't know what they were talking about. They've never been to the city of God. I, on the other hand, live there. It's my home. Come, follow me. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And what's amazing is that anyone can know this person. The one who lives there and has come down to us to show us how to get back. And what a person. He is the benchmark of reality. He is the test of reality. He is the truth personified. Now, one of Jesus' closest friends, a man called Peter, spent several years walking around Judea nearly 2,000 years ago with Jesus and the rest of the gang. And you know what it is. You're going to get to know people pretty well when you're wandering around in that sort of context, aren't you? And I don't know what you're like when you're tired or hungry, but I definitely get pretty tetchy and irritable. Then add the fact that in the ancient world there were no headache pills you could take or sunburn cream. Quite apart from the stress of wandering around and being opposed and spat at and given pretty hostile treatment, you can understand that in Jesus' gang there must have been some pretty frayed edges from time to time, don't you think? A bit of backbiting here and there. Just normal. But listen to what Peter can say about this man he lived with and others for 3 years. He committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. That's Peter writing in one of his letters in the New Testament. This man, he knew better than perhaps anybody else, and he can say there is no deceit in his mouth. What you see is what you get. Now, you may think that is just Peter's spin, but all kinds of people would back that up. And it's nothing less than what we would expect. After all, if Jesus is truth with a capital T, then he ought to have complete integrity too. And still, thousands were attracted to him. From tough as old nails soldiers, or ivory-towered academics, to peasants and fishermen, the whole lot. And it's fascinating. Jesus certainly had his enemies, but even his enemies realized he was different. Isn't it interesting? The problem people had with Jesus was never that he was a hypocrite, only that he was a threat to their power and prestige. They couldn't find anything on him. Even the people at his execution had to say, there is no just cause for his execution. With Jesus, what you see is what you get. He is the perfectly integrated life that has ever lived. He was courageous, but never bullish. He was gentle, but never a pushover. He was truthful and honest, but always gracious with it. He sometimes showed real anger, but his anger was always righteous. So Peter could say he committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. There's never been anyone quite like him. Never. Not a single one. In fact, it is arguable that he still has to be the most influential person who lived in human history. Without a shadow of doubt. No wonder the great poet T.S. Eliot could write, "Christ is the still point of a turning world." And when the world is turning so much with its many betrayals and broken promises and spin and suspicion, isn't this what makes Jesus so profoundly attractive? Are you cynical about reality? Well, there are many reasons to be in our world, but not about Jesus. He was truth personified. Secondly, he was a faithful friend. We might be cynical about our relationships, but you can't be with this one. Now, you might think that being near Jesus would make you very self-conscious. I don't know how you feel about being people who you feel, they're so much better than I am morally. You know, they're far too good. I couldn't possibly be with them. Do you know people like that? Far too priggish and self-righteous. What about with Jesus? After all, he's perfect. Kind of sort of shows you up somewhat, doesn't it? Makes you want to recoil. And indeed, when Peter first began to glimpse the true reality of Jesus after a miracle, he cowered in fear. And in the words of one modern translation, he said, "Master, leave. I'm a sinner and I cannot handle this holiness. Leave me to myself." But Jesus refused to leave. He was staying put. Jesus never denied Peter's sin. He knew that Peter, and this is what sin is all about in the Bible, Peter didn't live the life that God created him to live with God at the center of it. He knew that Peter hadn't done that. In fact, he knew Peter better than he knew himself. But here's the thing. That did not put Jesus off. Jesus is the truth. He is also love. He still loved Peter. And what Jesus did for Peter, he offers to do for any of us. Another disciple of Jesus wrote in his letter to the Hebrews, it's coming up on the screen, "Both the one who makes people holy and those who are made holy of the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters." Jesus knows we're not holy. He knows we're not up to it. He knows our lives fall far short of his perfect life. But because of his love, he's not put off. He does something about it. Just stop here for a moment. I mean, think of all Jesus' claims that I've mentioned so far. He is God amongst us. He is the source of all truth in the cosmos. He is the only person who lived a truly integrated life. Just suppose all that's true. Then add into the mix that he's not embarrassed to know us. Isn't that amazing? He's not ashamed. But for many people, that simple point alone is life-changing. You know, we might have plenty in our own lives to be ashamed of. I'm sure we all do. But that doesn't put Jesus off when we approach him. When he makes promises, he keeps them. Circumstances do not throw him. Self-interest never deters him. He keeps his word. He will be a faithful friend through thick and thin to the end for all who come to him. He is the truest friend we could ever hope to meet. There are reasons why people are cynical about relationships. You can't be cynical about this one. But let me finish with the most extraordinary aspect of all. What did he do with his power? To paraphrase the reading that Sarah read to us earlier, despite being God's equal in every way, Jesus never took advantage or exploited his position. He became an omnipotent servant. That's our third point. Now, that sounds like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it? But with Jesus, there's no contradiction. So just turn to the final passage to look at. Page 1163 in the Church Bible, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. It's encouraging to hear the rustle of papers, though. That shows you're actually awake. Top of page 1163, chapter 8, verse 9. Paul writing to a church in the ancient Greek city of Corinth. He says this, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that through his poverty you might become rich." Jesus had the power of the cosmos at his disposal, but he willingly, deliberately serves. That's no political spin at election time with, you know, promises to serve the interests of the electorate. We hear that a lot every few years. There's no spin here. He serves by going to the cross to die. Why? Because it's the only way. The only way to make imperfect people acceptable to a perfect God. For while Jesus is not ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters, he can never leave us as we are. To cut a long story short, that means going to the cross on our behalf. That is what he does with his power. Unlike everyone who has ever wielded power in history, even when they've done so with the most honorable of motives, there have been some great people in power down the centuries. But Jesus alone wields power with utter integrity and total love for others. He did it so that the poor might become rich, not financially, but eternally. The treasures and riches of heaven forever, that in and of ourselves we do not deserve and do not have, he gives them up that we might gain. Put it like this. Kings and emperors down the centuries have rallied their troops and armies and urged them to fight. They've called on their subjects to offer their lives for king and country. But King Jesus did the precise opposite. The king offered his own life for the sake of his subjects. That is unique. And that, in a nutshell, is why people still follow him today. Why I still follow him today. Because he can be trusted to use his power for love. So I can trust him enough to submit my life to him. I can trust him to keep his promises when so few around seem able to, even when I fail. I know that he'll always be consistent and have complete integrity. And I know that if something is true, it's true because he made it true. I can trust him even at the times when, frankly, I don't understand all that's going on, when I am let down and confused. I'll never be able to plumb the depths, but that doesn't matter. It's simply enough to be thrilled to know him, the one who is truth personified. I think we need to be realistic about where things are culturally in the West, in this country. There's no point denying it. There's no point pretending that things are not as they are. There is a despair about what is true and who we can trust. But this simply makes Jesus more relevant today than perhaps he's ever been. Now, if you've been struck by even a little bit of this, then all I would urge you to do is to spend more time with him. Find out more. Seek him more. Speak to him. Pray to him and say, Lord, show me yourself. I don't know this. I don't get this. Just, Lord, show me yourself. And perhaps, why not do that Christianity Explore course? There are slips in the seats. It starts this Wednesday. Find out. Spend time with Jesus. Because I can assure you that he uniquely gives us light in a dark world. Amen.